listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Today we welcome the wonderful William Kent Kruger, author of the series featuring Cork O'Connor, most recently Sulphur Springs, the 16th book in the series, winner of back-to-back Anthony Awards for Best Novel, and in 2014 his standalone book Ordinary Grace won the Edgar Award for Best Novel of 2013.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I'm really excited. My mum is a huge fan of yours, so she's very excited about this.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Very glad to hear that.
Sulphur Springs explores the weight of history and how the past not only shapes us but has a habit of returning to us. What inspired this idea of exploring our past?
Well, there's rich history to the Cork O'Connor series, and there's rich history to Cork himself. I write a series that across the course of the soon-to-be 17 novels...
That's huge.
Covers about 16 years in the lives of the characters. So the history of what has occurred both during the course of the series and prior to this series is a lot about what has shaped not only Cork, but all the participants in the stories. And, you know, I don't know about you, but history has certainly shaped me. Not just my own history, but the history that's gone on around me. And so I wanted to capture that dynamic, the dynamic of the personal history and the dynamic larger local, national, global history.
And with 17 books featuring Cork O'Connor, you must have such a deep affection for him.
Do you know what? With Cork and with all of the characters in the series, I certainly love them. I love spending time with Cork and with the O'Connor clan and with the old Indian Mide, Henry Malou. Mm. But they never cease to be just characters mm-hmm. for me. I don't relate to them. You know, I don't talk to them. They don't speak to me. And if you have followed my series, you're aware that if a story demands it, I'm willing to sacrifice just about anybody mm-hmm. For the sake of the story itself. That doesn't include Cork because, you know, he's got to be there. But anybody surrounding Cork that readers might just absolutely be in love with, if I put them in jeopardy, you know, you can't be absolutely certain they're going to make it to the end of that story. So I don't think of them as I think of real people.
Fair enough. I love Uncle Henry's philosophy, especially of fear and anxiety, and I think that can be a great comfort in the modern world. And he says the fact that we're always driven by anxiety, he suggests that until we know the outcome, why not imagine the more optimistic outcome? Otherwise, we just make ourselves sick with anxiety. And I feel like that's something the modern world could really take on.
Yeah, isn't that a wise piece of advice?
Oh, so wise.
You know, when Henry Malou opens his mouth, I'm never quite sure what he's going to say. But whatever he says, it's just the right thing. Mm. It's like magic.
That philosophy must be inside you somewhere.
You know, well, the truth is, I think that those of us who are storytellers, if we sink ourselves really deeply into the imagining of a story, do in fact go someplace that's below our conscious thought. And what we bring up often surprises us, and we wonder, where the hell did that come from?
Yeah, and I think with Uncle Henry as well, I mean, I know in our modern society with anxiety and depression, you know, they just keep on increasing. I think his philosophy is so important even for, you know, us today. And I wonder if there's a way back for modern society.
Oh, you're asking the wrong guy.
Yeah, I love books that bring up just more questions.
I operate on what works best for me. and through Henry, I try to suggest maybe some avenues for other people as well, but I am certainly not going to prescribe the right road for anyone.
It's funny though, because as I was reading it, I'd often have to stop and think, oh wow, it's almost like a self-help book. I know one of the quotes was, the demons that plague you, you may think that you've dealt with them, driven them out with logic, put them to rest with prayer, but they're never really gone. They're always with you because they're not things separate from you. They are you. I think that's just such wisdom.
Well, thank you. I'm not sure where that came from either.
I love
but
that.
But I do remember crafting that particular paragraph, and it felt true to me as I was crafting it. And you know, that's the thing about a really good story. And I'm not saying I wrote a really good story, but I think I did. A really good story speaks to you on a very deep level, and it taps, I think, wisdom that we all have, and we just need to be reminded of.
Yeah, I totally agree. As I was reading, I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense, you know, and just there's a lot of trying to just be at peace with your situation and, you know, with what's going on, because a lot of the things obviously that goes on with Corky can't control it because it's his environment and other people. But all these pieces of wisdom just found throughout the novel, I just found so wise.
Well, I'm happy to hear that. You know, one of the conceits of the novel from the very beginning, for readers who know my series, they know that I typically will set my stories in the Great North Woods of Minnesota, which is a very different Lauren Desert of southern Arizona. And what I wanted to achieve here was the sense of a fish out of water for Cork, a man who feels quite comfortable and at home, and whose whole history really is centered in the Great North Woods where he grew up. But he finds himself in a place that's totally alien to him. And part of his challenge is trying to figure out how he can come to terms with this alien environment, understand it, and be able to embrace what it offers him so that it doesn't kill him.
Yeah, I did find the setting, it was almost a character in itself. It was so foreboding, and it highlighted the danger and the risks and the criminal activity as well. How did you go about creating that setting?
Well, I'm not tremendously familiar with southern Arizona. I do spend time in northern Arizona, and there are significant differences between northern and southern Arizona, although they're both quite desert environments. So I had to go down and do a lot of research. Boy, did I love the research for this book. So, yeah, I spent a good deal of time in southern Arizona just soaking up the environment itself, visiting all the places that I thought I might want to use as backdrops for the story. It deals a lot, at the heart of it is the question of how we handle the situation of the refugees who continue to stream across the border between the United States and Mexico. And so I interviewed all kinds of people down there. I interviewed the local constabulary. I interviewed the border patrol officers. I interviewed people who actually live right along the wall, that wall that's been built. What is essentially a war was what kind of an impact it was having on the people who have to live there. So it was both the environment I was trying to understand and the sort of the geopolitical backdrop for everything that I wanted to write about.
What surprised you the most about speaking to such a diverse group of people?
Well, what surprised me when I talked to the people who actually live along the border on this side of that border wall is how the people who come across don't really bother them so much. It's not the fact that there are people coming across, and it's not, although the drugs bother them, what I found is that they have adopted sort of a live and let live philosophy. So, for example, the drug traffickers, they know where the drug traffickers go in and go out. They know the pathways they follow, and they simply avoid them. And the drug traffickers know where people hike and where people are going to be, and they avoid those areas. So it's sort of like this mutual agreement. And the people, I found just an enormous amount of compassion down there among the people for the situation of the refugees who were coming across. So I spoke with volunteers in the humanitarian organizations down there who, in fact, go out into the desert and put out water and food and blankets and clothing and shoes, especially shoes, because many of the women, they're mostly women and children these days who are coming across the border. And many of them have walked hundreds or thousands of miles to get there, and their shoes are worn to nothing. So the compassion was wonderful. Most surprising conversations I had were with the Border Protection officers, the Border Patrol people. I tried to contact the Divisional Office for Border Protection down there in Tucson before I went, but I never got a reply to my requests for interviews. So when I went down to the desert, I just went out there and found Border Patrol officers who were doing their jobs out in that godforsaken landscape, and I talked to them. And they told me what they do, and they told me how they, and most importantly, how they feel about what they do. And that was so enlightening.
Was there some conflict, obviously, between what they do and what they feel they should be doing?
Well, the Border Patrol officers I talked to at heart believe their primary responsibility is to make sure that people don't die.
Mm-hmm.
And to that end, they are vigilant in trying to track people as they come across the border. Their secondary responsibility, of course, is to apprehend and turn over to the system of justice that we have here, if you can call it that, that deals with the undocumented immigrants. But their primary responsibility is the safety of the people. And then secondarily, the security of the border itself.
Mm-hmm. And I liked the idea, and that's what you were trying to get across, is maybe they weren't innocent in the eyes of the law, but there's something more important than the law, and that's simply compassion. And it's a really nice thought, because not everything's black and white, and although we obviously need laws to keep us safe, laws are unable to protect everybody. So I think the alternate perspective of the novel was really important and encourages people to think in a different, maybe more empathetic way.
I hope so. I knew, because this is the immigration situation here in the United States is one of the most divisive that we've faced, because I took a particular stance, fairly compassionate, I thought, liberal stance in how I believe we ought to respond. I knew I was going to get a lot of pushback from people who believe strongly on the other side of the issue. And in fact, I did. I've had a number of readers write to me and say, you know, I followed your series the whole way, but I'm not going to read you again because I absolutely disagree with your take on this situation.
Well, that's really interesting. It's interesting that, you know, not only, you know, that you obviously can have your own opinion, but you won't even read an alternate perspective.
Well, that's so incredibly narrow.
Yes, absolutely.
It doesn't surprise me.
Even if you disagree with something, isn't it interesting to see the other person's point of view?
That's one of the things I love about mysteries. Across the course of my series, I've been able to put at the heart of the stories significant social issues about which I feel passionately. And what I've generally speaking discovered that is that so long as I couch that social issue within the context of a good, compelling mystery, even people who don't necessarily agree with my point of view will still read me. So occasionally I get emails from people who do complain about the fact that my admittedly liberal bleeding heart sensibilities find their way into my stories. Up until Sulphur Springs, I'd never had anybody tell me they weren't going to read me anymore.
Well, I think if that's happening, you're doing it right, I think.
You know, I'm thinking the same thing. I've touched some areas that are sensitive, and I'm hoping that even those people who said they aren't going to read me are maybe thinking a little bit now about the situation in a different way than they thought before.
Yeah, and that's the power of reading, isn't it? It is for entertainment, but if you can change the world while you're doing it or change parts of the world, I mean, you're doing something right.
Stories can do so much more than entertain us. They can enlighten us and encourage us and inspire us. Stories are powerful, powerful tools in changing the world.
Absolutely. And although unsurprising, and we've touched on it a bit, I found it just so disappointing that so much prejudice still exists today. And I like how Rainey becomes the voice of this. And she says to Cork, "Your native blood doesn't show, Cork. You don't get looked at twice. To be Indian anywhere, to be Mexican, especially here. Can you imagine how difficult that is?" And I think for most people, maybe they can't imagine how difficult it is. So I thought it was so important to give that alternate voice and provide that voice for Rainey and other people in her situation.
Well, I'm glad you picked up on that. Thank you. Because that is, in fact, one of Rainey's responsibilities in this story is to continue to point that out to Cork. Because Cork is a man, he is of mixed heritage. He is part Irish-American and part Ojibwe. But he is also he also comes from a significant law enforcement background. Mm-hmm. And so he has that perspective that he has to deal with as well. And that pisses Rainey off sometimes.
But it's like they balance each other out, you know, because they have
I like that too. And I think they're two strong forces at work.
Yeah, it's exactly what we were saying. Two people who do have differing perspectives, they can still come together and learn to love each other and respect each other's opinions. So there's a lesson in that.
I certainly hope so.
You also explore the secrets we keep within ourselves and the fact that no matter how much we think we know someone, most people have a part of themselves they're unwilling to share. And Cork says, but the truth is that you always keep some deep part of yourself separate. You hold a place inside that's only for you and that you never let anyone else into. I found that really was a truth for humanity. Are we obliged to reveal our past, do you think?
Oh, I don't think we're obliged.
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting idea, though, because I think that's true with all of
And because of the fear that causes us to keep that part to ourselves, I think we're always in bondage to the secrets we keep. Do you know, that's probably what confession, the ritual of confession that exists in a number of religions, probably most notably the Catholic religion, can help, I think, in removing that burden. If people really do, in fact, confess, and that environment is truly one of trust. But, you know, confessing to a priest who doesn't really know you is a great deal different from confessing to someone you deeply love and who you might be afraid will turn away from you because the secret is so dark.
Yeah, there's a vulnerability to it, isn't there?
And that's both Rainey's situation and Cork's. Mm. The secrets they hold are so dark, they're afraid to reveal them because they might not be loved in the way that they would like to be. Mm.
I also love the line, which was repeated throughout the novel, wherever you are, there I am also. And there's a bit of a joke about it at the beginning when his mother says it, because, you know, she loves reading fiction and things. But I thought, as much as it shows, you know, about love and everything, it also shows the inevitability of loss and how we navigate these losses. It was just such a beautiful line. And being a mother myself, I thought, yeah, it's such a beautiful line.
Do you know, if you can, fairly early on in a story, find a line that is going to be this resonant echo that you can use judiciously throughout the course of the story, I think you're really fortunate. And I found that line early on.
Yeah, it was lovely. I still think about that now, even with my own children.
Oh, good. I've had a number of readers write to me about that specific.
It must be nice when a line resonates with people.
And tell me how much they appreciated it. In fact, I'm happy when anything resonates with anybody.
A lot of your novel, this one particularly, resonated with me a lot for some reason.
You, there in Australia, you have a desert, huge desert.
Yeah.
You have a significant Aboriginal population.
Yeah.
You deal with a lot of the same issues over there that I deal with in my stories here. So I'm imagining that it's easy for you to identify with the issues, the stories that I create.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I found too. I found there were parallels, even though it was so far away and a little bit removed. There were so many parallels to, you know, what we experience here in Australia. I loved the analogy and the naive optimism where the father gives the son a pile of horse shit, and instead of being upset, he says, that means there must be a pony somewhere. And Sylvester says, which I wholeheartedly agree with, the world needs more people like you folks. It's such a true statement in our current political climate, but I loved it. It was so funny.
You've never heard that story before?
I haven't.
Oh, it's an old story. My father told that to me long, long ago, but I thought it was so perfect to give the reader a sense of who Sylvester is.
Yeah, I really like Sylvester. He was one of my favorite
characters. Yeah, me too. Yeah. You know, Sylvester's an interesting case study in how you have a character who you don't intend to use in ultimately the way you use him. Mm-hmm. Sylvester, when I initially conceived of him, was just going to be a guy sitting in the bar drinking, and I needed two guys in the bar. Mm-hmm. And he was one of them. And then I began to think about, well, he's kind of an interesting guy. Maybe I can use him in other ways. And he just did a great job for me.
Mm, I love that when the characters drive your story.
Caught me by surprise and just pleased me tremendously.
Yeah, no, I agree. I sort of felt that, actually. I thought he was a character that sort of emerged himself. He decided he was going to emerge.
Oh, I like that. He decided.
Something Something else that resonated with me was your idea of celebrity, and you say, "We've a culture of celebrity. We bow down before the gods of Kardashian. The only real people left in the world are the ones standing on the street corners with a sign asking for a handout." And it's not untrue. And in Australia, we have this growing culture of the obsession with celebrity and being fascinated by fame for fame's sake. And, you know, with the idea of YouTube and camera phones, it's almost like anyone can achieve fame for, you know, any reason. And we're somehow driven towards this. And it's a kind of a sad state of affairs.
Oh, absolutely it is. And I don't know what to do about that. You know, you ask, how do we get back to a place of compassion and a place of truth? And, oh, Danny, I don't know. And it concerns me tremendously.
Yeah,
who we are becoming, I'm fearful about.
There was a survey of young kids done quite recently, and they said, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I know when I answered that question when I was 5, I was like, oh, I want to be a vet, or I want to be a teacher or a doctor or a writer. Now kids are saying, I want to be famous, and that just hurts my feelings a lot.
oh yeah. Well, the world history, life, it's a pendulum. It swings one way. Maybe it's going to swing back.
Hopefully. But I think with people like you providing that perspective and voice, I mean, as long as we keep pushing back against it, it'll, you know, it will swing back, hopefully. Fingers crossed. I've read that you've named To Kill a Mockingbird as a favorite.
It has always been my favorite since I very first read it. Mm-hmm. It has been my favorite American novel because it, you know, from the point of view of a storyteller, it's a perfect story. The voice is so real. It may be the truest narrative voice in American fiction. The language is powerful. The evocation of place is just dead on. And the themes that it tackles are universal themes. It's just a great, great piece of writing. And there are people who have written to me and told me that that my novel Ordinary Grace reminds them of To Kill a Mockingbird, and I have always found that comparison to be quite complimentary. I have appreciated that.
Yeah, I found the parallels as well in Sulphur Springs, because I thought you're still providing that perspective of people who've suffered because of prejudice, and that's exactly what Harper Lee does.
Yeah, exactly. At least in that novel.
Yeah. And is it nice to take a break from Cork O'Connor with your standalone novels?
Yes, it is, as a matter of fact. So the standalone Ordinary Grace was, it's probably the best thing I've ever written. And it was a wonderful and unique experience in so many ways, not just to step away from the Cork O'Connor novels, but because I was writing a story that was so true for me. It came so much out of my own experience. I'm writing a companion novel to that. When you write a standalone, you don't have those same expectations. Mm-hmm. You can pretty much do anything you want to do. And I really, really enjoy that.
And Ordinary Grace won an award in 2014, didn't it? So the Edgar Award for Best Novel?
Yeah, it won every award it could in the mystery business.
Wow.
It just kind of walked away. Because it spoke, I think, to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It was a novel that spoke to a lot of people on really deep levels.
And that must have been nice that people don't just love Cork, they also love the other writing that you do too.
Yeah, that was a kick. I love that.
Well, I read that you write your manuscripts by hand in a spiral notebook. I love that because I love handwriting and I think it really helps with the thinking process. What is it about writing by hand that helps your writing process?
Well, for the sake of full disclosure, I wrote my first 8 or 9 novels longhand, mm-hmm. and then I moved to writing directly to the computer. I began the novels, I wrote them longhand because I have always written in coffee shops, mm-hmm. and this goes back now almost 30 years when we didn't have laptop computers. So I would go to the coffee shop in the morning and with my notebook and my pen and write for about an hour and 15 minutes before I went to work every day. So that began the process of writing my stories longhand. And for me, it was kind of part of the magic, the creative magic. So the story was born in my head, but it was filtered through my heart and then went down my arm, through my hand, and the pen onto the page. But at one point I was dreadfully behind deadline, and if you were longhand, you have to transcribe that. I kept a record, a log, a chronicle of the development of each of those novels. Each of those novels took me about 6 or 7 full notebooks.
Wow.
And when I kept the notebooks and would look back, I would see all those messy pages with things scrawled out and marked out and arrows pointing for a paragraph to be moved and all that messy process. And that was kind of fun.
Mm. I love what you say about from your head to your brain to your hand, but like there's not enough of that.
Well, in that process, it's a slower process. And so I think it allows you to ruminate a little bit more on the words that you're going to use.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally, Desolation Mountain, released in 2018. Can you tell us anything about this new release?
Yeah, it involves the crash of a U.S. senator's airplane in a remote area in northern Minnesota. It actually crashes on the Iron Lake Reservation. Cork is drawn into a web of political deceit like nothing he could ever have imagined.
I can't wait for it to be released as a follow-up to Sulphur Springs, which I really enjoyed. I hope that came through with the questions that I asked.
It did. And I so appreciate that you enjoyed this story, Danny. Thank you.
Well, I have to thank my mum for putting me onto it. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And like I said, I love Sulphur Springs and I really look forward to your new work. So thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Can I ask a favor?
Of course.
Could you please give your mother a hug for me?
I would love to give my mother a hug. I think we should give our mothers a hug daily.
Absolutely, absolutely. You take care, Danny. It's been just an enjoyable conversation.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favorite authors.